An old Chinese curse reads, "May you live in interesting times." The word interesting in this context is a stand-in for turbulent, chaotic, perilous, threatening, and other uncomfortable synonyms. Our world today is nothing if not interesting. Pandemic disease, economic chaos, political turmoil, racial strife, and police violence all combined to present seemingly existential threats to our way of life. But we've been here before. The decade of the 1960s was, in many ways, just as chaotic, and we managed to get through that period more or less intact. We all faced challenges then and now to live up to our responsibilities as humans in a less than perfect world, to be good citizens and neighbors, to be patriots of our nation, to leave a better world to our children than the one we were given. And the perennial question is always, what do I do? What is my responsibility as an individual facing the mess we're all in? Today, I'm going to explore my own experiences then and now, not to preach solutions or advise others how to behave, but as food for thought, as we all struggle with the moral, political, and sociological dilemmas we face. I was 12 years old in 1960 when John Kennedy was elected president. On my 13th birthday, I watched his inauguration. Then less than 3 years later, he was assassinated in Dallas, and the whole world watched in horror as his suspected assassin was shot to death on live TV. It was the beginning of a decade almost unprecedented in its chaotic course. In August of 1964, Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which gave Lyndon Johnson the green light to launch the Vietnam War, the longest in our history to that time. The early 60s gave rise to racial strife throughout the South. Race riots, marches, lunch counter sit-ins, freedom riders. Medgar Evers was shot in the driveway of his own home. Three young activists from New York were murdered in Mississippi. Four little black girls died in a church bombing in Birmingham, Alabama. In 1965, Bloody Sunday took place as protesters marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. But the most tumultuous year of the decade was clearly 1968. In January, the Tet Offensive began in Saigon and saw the bloodiest fighting to date in the Vietnam War. It was followed by the My Lai massacre, and these events together turned the tide of American opinion against the war, though it took five more years for it to end. In April, Martin Luther King was assassinated on a motel balcony in Memphis, followed predictably by riots in most major U.S. cities. In June, Robert Kennedy was assassinated in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. In August, the Democratic Convention in Chicago resulted in massive police riots. The ensuing turmoil paved the way for Richard Nixon's Republican nomination and election to the presidency. The musical Hair debuted on Broadway. The Beatles released the White Album, later made famous by the Manson family killings. And the only movie about Vietnam that was made during Vietnam was released, The Green Berets. John Wayne was the director and star, and it was produced by Michael Wayne, John's eldest son. It was a naked and blatant propaganda effort to shore up flagging public support for the war. That was the year I met my first future wife, became disillusioned and dropped out of college, and faced the very real prospect of carrying a rifle in a jungle 7,000 miles from home and murdering complete strangers. By luck, either good or bad, I largely missed the racial turmoil of the early 60s, a bit too young and politically immature to take an active role. But by 1969, I was deep into the political struggle over Vietnam. War truck protests were regular fare for me at San Fernando Valley State College, the antecedent to Cal State Northridge. I remember attending a concert by Joan Baez at which she collected draft cards from all the men in attendance who wished to protest the war by burning them. I declined, still undecided on my course of action. I was a strong opponent of the Vietnam War. My sense of outrage that my country could kill and maim thousands, eventually millions, of innocent men, women, and children for what seemed to me naked imperialist goals made my blood boil. But I'm not a pacifist per se. My father proudly fought Nazis in World War II and counted that as one of his most important life efforts. I agree with Barack Obama's observation. He said, I'm not opposed to all wars. I'm opposed to dumb wars. And Vietnam surely fit that mold. But what to do? When I dropped out of college, I was instantly reclassified 1A and subject to almost immediate draft. The lottery had not yet been instituted. But I did have choices, and I observed several of my friends making theirs. One succeeded in attaining conscientious objector status, principal aided by his well-documented years as an active member of the Unitarian Universalist Church. That path was out of reach for me, but I remembered a year later when Peggy and I sought religious experience for our four-year-old son. Another friend took the drastic step of fleeing to Canada, unable to return for the rest of his life. That choice would cut me off from friends and family forever, and I ruled it out as well. But I found a third path that seemed to fit. If I did nothing, the draft would almost certainly send me to Vietnam, but anyone who volunteered to serve their country was looked upon favorably. I tested and qualified for enlistment in the Navy and was promised a job as air crew on helicopters conducting anti-submarine warfare. Of particular importance to me was the fact that Vietnam did not have any submarines. In the end, fate smiled upon my decision. All military helicopters are tasked with a secondary role regardless of their primary mission: search and rescue. In June 1972, Hurricane Agnes devastated much of the eastern U.S. seaboard. My squadron spent 2 days rescuing civilians from floodwaters in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Instead of death and destruction, I was blessed that the only significant military action I ever took consisted in saving lives. It was in the 60s that I grew up, physically, emotionally, politically, and yes, spiritually. In junior high school, I never marched for civil rights with the millions who did, but their struggles and sacrifices touched me deeply. Their injustices infuriated me and woke me to a sense that I, personally, had some responsibility toward the world. Then, when the outrage of Vietnam began, I was ripe for political activism. That sense of obligation to my world, my nation, and my fellow humans has not left me. I still become enraged when I see the world around me today and the overlapping challenges we face. Politically, we're just ending 3 years of most chaotic and many say destructive presidential administrations in American history. Systemic racism, always present but somewhat latent in recent years, has suddenly exploded into the collective consciousness of our nation. Police murders have seemingly become almost common. The deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Rayshard Brooks, and others have resulted in massive demonstrations strongly reminiscent of the 1960s. And the government response has been to assemble National Guard and Army Air War units around the nation's capital and drive peaceful protesters away with tear gas and rubber bullets so the president could hold a Bible upside down for a photo opportunity. A photograph. COVID-19 is pandemic. Where the rest of the world is at least attempting solutions, America is on a steep decline through lack of planning and action. To date, over 3 million US citizens have been infected, resulting in 135,000 deaths. On Friday alone, over 70,000 more Americans became ill. And without thoughtful leadership, we're reduced to arguing whether wearing face covers is patriotic or unmanly. The pandemic has devastated our economy. Unemployment is nearly as high as it was during the Great Depression of the 1930s. Countless small businesses have been closed, unlikely to return. In a short 39-day period, from February 12th to March 23rd, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 40% of its value, leaving millions of retirements in jeopardy. We're fighting for justice and equality, even in mere survival, on several fronts, but we're like a boxer with one arm tied behind his back. Where we should be gathering together in large numbers to strive for what's right, COVID-19 makes us keep our social distance. I've got double jeopardy on this virus thing. I'm 72 years old, still fighting a daily battle with cancer, and my immune system was shot to hell years ago. Many of you face similar threats. My heart tells me to hit the streets in protest, like millions of others. But I can't, and neither should you. We're in a war here, and coronavirus is the principal enemy. If you catch it, you will have unwillingly joined the other side of the battle. Your health and safety are more than a selfish personal priority. They are a patriotic duty. If you get ill, you become a carrier of the disease. More than that, if you go into the hospital, you'll take up precious, scarce resources, hospital beds, PPE, nurses, doctors. You'll become a burden on society instead of one of its defenders. So if you're feeling guilty, we're not getting outside and doing enough, stop. There are other ways you can help. We can still make our voices heard, and I plan to. Write to the mayor, the county supervisor, the governor, state assembly member and senators, U.S. members of Congress. Phone calls are good too. Give money to progressive politicians and causes. The biggest election in generations is coming up fast. I can't knock on doors, but I'm signed up for UU the Vote, so I can work to help replace the current leadership in Washington. I think someone's going to put a link in the chat for UU the Voice. I encourage you. Volunteers are always needed to lick stamps, make posters, contact voters to advocate for change. I'm busy on cell phone and Zoom, staying connected with others of goodwill, and building hope and energy for the struggles ahead. Meanwhile, I'm using my hands to make face masks for farm workers in Oxnard. For those of us who are not so physically challenged, there are even more opportunities to make the world a better place. Put on a full Monty of PPE and head out the door. Grocery shop for seniors carefully. Work a food bank safely. Volunteer to help run errands for those less fortunate in masks and gloves. There's still a great big world of needy folks, and you can join the army of those who meet their needs if you do it thoughtfully, maintaining your own health. If you want to help but don't know where to start, Google the word volunteer on the internet, but stand back for what comes your way. Groups formed for political action of every stripe abound. Social and service clubs already have programs to join. Here's a great idea. Connect with our own Chalice Justice Ministries in racial and cultural justice or climate justice. Unitarian Universalists have a legacy of deeds, not creeds. Our work for a better world calls us to harness love's power to stop oppression and break down divisions. Heal isolation and honor the interconnectedness of all life and all justice issues. From grassroots community organization to interfaith, state, national, and corporate advocacy, in protest marches, prayer vigils, press conferences, homeless shelters, and prisons, Unitarian Universalists put our faith into action. And today, we do so in a responsible, safe manner with masks, gloves, and shields. Each of you hearing my words today already have an inside track for this. Just go to the Jalous webpage, and get hooked up with your friends and neighbors who are already in the struggle. Perhaps the most important thing we all can do is not lose hope. We've survived worse before, and we'll get through all the current crises. Most Americans are good, caring people, willing to add their strength and energy to make the world a better place. When our leadership fails us for a time, we will step up and fill the void. There will be bitter days ahead. As a famous songwriter once wrote, all you need is love. Blessed be.